Even in 1930, the appropriations for 30-31 were increased rather than decreased. Mm-hmm. That was still during the McKenzie-King regime, but in 32 and 33, appropriations 32-33, Bennett was in power, and there was a drastic cut. Now, you can argue that it was necessary, and sure it was. The economy was in very bad shape. I don't think it was necessary to go as far as they did. The Air Force, the Army cut wasn't very severe. Most people recall the reduction in the Army appropriations. It was about 18-20%. The Air Force cut was between 70-75%. It was. Our appropriations in those days were not large. They will sound to you abysmally small. I think our appropriation at that time was, before the cut, was about $5.5 million.
Bought a lot of new equipment with that, can't you?
But the appropriation after the cut was $1.75 million.
Oh.
$1.75 million. There wasn't enough. And now this had a great effect throughout the service, not only on morale, but on tactical, on professional skills. There wasn't enough money to buy the fuel to put in the aircraft to maintain the skills and the practice of the younger pilots. Mm-hmm. There were pilots who were grounded because there wasn't enough money for them to fly. You only flew on some priority tasks. I happened to have a priority task at that time. But those who weren't on any priority, they didn't. Now, for example, I had in the winter of 33-34, I was chief instructor on the photographic course there at Rockcliffe. Mm-hmm. Henry Carscallon was one of the chaps who just entered the service before the cut. And he was assigned to me for employment on any job I saw fit, anything that to occupy him, so long as he wasn't flying an aircraft. If he were using fuel, I couldn't use him in that capacity. I could use him as an aide or an executive or anything like that. Right. Here he was, a keen young chap, just joined the service, wanted to further his flying career, not able to fly. So things were...
I suppose the point I was thinking of here was that even in the 20s, when there was money available, money was not being channeled into the services, which could have been.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mackenzie King, in that period of time, and his government, did very little to further build up the defense forces. And for example, the Air Force wasn't a military formation at all in those days. It was a civil organization, really.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're carrying out the photo.
There was no interest or urging on the part of the government to make it other than a civil organization. It didn't really have any fighter squadrons or bomber squadrons or army co-op squadrons. Tactical.
Well, the 20s was still the period where they actually believed that there would never be another war.
Yeah, that's right.
So
absolutely.
There was no need to have a tactical air force and such.
Yeah. True.
Excitedness, but
but
understandable, I think, after that, the First World War.
Yes. Oh, yes. There was an aversion and abhorrence.
Well, let me ask you a personal question. What was your political affiliation or viewpoint, or say at an election, who would you vote for? Conservative or liberal?
Well, I have alternated a bit on that, and I have voted both ways. Mm-hmm. I come from a strong conservative background.
I would guess that, actually. Yeah.
My father was a staunch conservative. I can remember him taking me to, and when I was quite a young lad, to listen to and to meet Arthur Meehan.
Mm-hmm.
That's going back a bit.
Yeah.
And of course, Arthur Meehan made me feel very distinguished by shaking my hand and, and thanking me for my support and, and so on, so on. And I must say that I was appointed to be chief of the air staff by a conservative minister. Now that really shouldn't have any influence, but I think sometimes it does and has. It was no, it wasn't Perks. It was Doug Harkness.
The fellow who replaced him.
Yeah. Doug Harkness was the one who asked me if I would take over the post as chief of the air staff. I was at that time the deputy chief staff operations at SHAPE, Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe. We were at a party at the a dinner party actually at the residence of the ambassador to NATO, Jules Leger, mm-hmm. when Doug Harkness said, "I would like to step into the ambassador's office for a moment." And, we went in there. I didn't know what he had in his mind, and it was then he said, "I would like you to take over the post of chief of the air staff when Hugh Campbell retires." And so that was how it came about.
Were you the logical choice for the posting, or were there other people that?
Well, there were certainly other people that
were competent,
were in the wings, but Campbell had been the chief for 4 years. He was one of the ones who jumped me when I had that award of a year's loss of seniority. So he became chief before me. He might have become chief after me if things had not been as they were.
Mm-hmm. But you were in the post at a very interesting time, weren't you?
That's right, yes. I was the chief from 1962 to 64. I started off my first, it was within my first 2 weeks, I think, in office with the Cuban crisis on my hands, and then after that, after Harkness, was forced to leave that post by Diefenbaker, because Harkness supported the policy of nuclear weapons for the Canadian forces.
Yeah, and Diefenbaker
and his foreign minister of external affairs, Mr. Green, was very much against that, and Churchill was very much against it. That is Gordon Churchill. And you remember there was a revolt at one of the caucus meetings, and a fair number of the caucus members were going to stand up and support Harkness in his nuclear policy.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them took cold feet at the moment, and Doug Harkness was, for example, George Hees was, and a number like that were going to be his supporters, and they chickened out.
Mm-hmm.
And Harkness was cast off, and Gordon Churchill was put in his place, which was a sad, sorry day. He was not a good defense minister.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, there was a change of government, and in came the Liberals, and we were faced with another crisis in the form of Hallier.
Oh, yeah.
So you're quite right when you said that my period of time was...
I know this is way off topic, but it interests me, okay? Did you have anything to do with the arrow or the missile controversy, or had that passed by the time you had got in?
Well, Yes, I did, but it had passed before I became chief of the air staff.
Mm-hmm.
When I was vice chief, and I was vice chief from 55 to 58, 54, 58.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the Aero era. Roy Slamon was the chief when I became vice chief. But he had been chief for quite a while then, and we were dealing with the Aero at that time. And then Hugh Campbell took over as the chief of the air staff. And it was during Hugh Campbell's regime that the contract was canceled. I guess the contract was canceled about 1958, 59 in that area. And I was near the end of my tour of duty there. In fact, I left for Paris and for Sheep in 58, late 58. So, yes, I had a fair amount to do with the Aero through various parts of its development. And I can't remember precisely. Isn't it terrible to fail to remember a thing like this? Whether that cancellation... I think it was in process when I left for Paris. Whether it actually was finalized or not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember Crawford Gordon coming to Ottawa on a great stage of agitation when it looked as though it was going to be canceled, and taking all sorts of drastic steps to circumvent it. And I think that was just about the time I was leaving Paris.
A good decision in your eyes, or a bad decision? And taking everything into consideration, economic factors as well as strictly military.
I think it was a bad decision, yes. I think that... It was financially a heavy burden.
But a short-sighted
fighter aircraft, by that time, had become very expensive. And there was a heavy squeeze, therefore, on the other services. It would have meant that the Air Force, which already had the major portion of the defense appropriations,
and rightly so,
would have required still more. I think that there were ways that this could have been circumvented. The development costs of that aircraft, I think, could have been financed from means other than the defense vote.
The
Defense Production or something, Department of Defense Production or something like that. Because there were, if you'd gone ahead, the chances of foreign sales or sales were, although they were not great, they were there. I think the United States would have purchased a quantity. How many, I don't know. They had the problem of competition with their own industry. But we had such a good rapport with the Defense Department of the United States and with the U.S. Air Force,
mm-hmm.
That there would have been some purchases made, just the way the U.S. have purchased through the years a number of British aircraft on
the
good development
issue.
Yeah. And other air forces, like the Australian, instead of buying the F-111, which didn't prove to be very good for them, probably would have purchased. And there were a few countries that would have. But apart from that, it would have been a tremendous thing for the aviation industry. Now, the engine, which was to be used in the Aero, was a Canadian design and very advanced. It incorporated techniques and the use of light metals, which were ahead of any other development in the world at the time.
And didn't they have to develop a whole new airframe simply to facilitate this engine? I mean, it was Canadian design?
It was a Canadian design engine, yeah. That engine had great promise, and that development was cut off and dropped too at the same time the Aero was. There were one or two unfortunate things about the Aero development. The missile the performance of the aircraft was such that it could operate well in the forward areas of any attack, mm-hmm. on the distant approaches of any target zone. And therefore, the intention was that you would destroy incoming aircraft before they got to the point where they could attack their targets. And it was not only a long-range aircraft, but a high-performance aircraft. Therefore, you needed a missile system and a missile and a fire control system that could engage aircraft at a long range. The relative speeds of the aircraft at that time were great. This was a supersonic aircraft.
And you
therefore had to have the ability to open fire at long range. Mm-hmm. And that meant a special weapon system and the chosen missile. I'm just trying to remember the name of it at the moment. Sparrow 3, I think it was. Mm-hmm. A U.S. Navy development, was the only one on them that had reached that state of development. And unfortunately, the Navy slowed up on their development of that weapon in the midst of the Arrow program, and that was a...
Intentionally?
Well, they had the Sparrow 2 and the Sparrow 3, and they decided that they would their requirements could be met by the Sparrow 2 for a longer period than they had originally planned. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they delayed the development of the 3, and that was going to cost, that meant that we would have to pick up the development costs on the Sparrow 3. And that had a fair bearing on the final decision. There were a number of, that was just bad luck. The Sparrow 3 ultimately was developed. It was a damn good weapon. But the U.S. Navy didn't help us on that one. Yeah. However, we are getting a long way out from Europe.
About 30 years, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
What were we talking about?
We've
spoken enough about that. Yeah. Though I still haven't found out what political affiliation you had in the 1930s, if any.
Yeah. Well, none would be the answer to that.
Did you ever get sermons by the minister on a Sunday on church parade that had any political content?
No.
Much like you get today?
No.
Nothing like that
at all. No.
And commanding officers were not trying to sway you at all?
Indeed, that's an interesting point we haven't covered. There weren't any padres in the service.
Not at all.
In my time. There weren't any associated with any of the stations I was on, perhaps because the stations were a little bit on the small side, mm-hmm. and perhaps because we didn't have a chaplaincy branch of the service in those days. That came later on. Mm-hmm. If we had, I don't know what time it is, if we had church services, to be quite honest, I can't remember a service at Camp Borden. We occasionally had a drumhead service, and a padre from the nearest neighboring town would conduct the service, or somebody would be brought up from Toronto to Camp Borden to participate in the drumhead service. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't any church. The only place you could assemble for church service, of course, would have been in the theater. Too appropriate.
Yeah. I was listening to an interview that Dr. Roy had done with General Clark, and he said that when he initially appeared at Camp Borden, the adjutant asked him what religion was he, and he was Presbyterian, but he was given the choice of C of E and RC, and he couldn't deviate from that.
That's right. Those were the accepted religions. You were, on parade if there were to be a church service, say a special occasion like a drumhead service or a remembered service, the parade would form up in toto on the parade square. All the personnel in the station would be there, and then at a certain point, the order would be given to follow the Roman Catholics and the Jews. So that left everybody else who was left was CV. all those who left had to march off to the CV service.
It seems funny too that General Clark said that Roman Catholic services were held at 7 o'clock and CV were held at 8 o'clock, so if anyone was in doubt, they all put CV so they get an extra hour's worth of sleep.
Yeah.
How large?
Well, now, he went on to the Signal Corps in Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
And the Signal Corps in Kingston had a very well-developed station and mess life and social life, and it was just on the fringes of a city area,
mm-hmm.
so that they had much greater access to the clergy, and it would be easier to set up church services. And I guess I'm not sure whether the army had any chaplains at that time or not, but they probably had some associated with their reserve forces. Maybe they had chaplains in the reserve. I'm sure they must have, and therefore they had a sort of contact with God, which was more intimate than ours in the Air Force.
Well, one could argue that being up in the plane that high gave you a lecture. So I take it that religion didn't play too large a part of the serviceman's life.
No, it didn't really. Of course, it changed through the years when we had a chaplain's branch and when we had our own churches on base.
Mm-hmm.
During the war, there were church services were a regular event on bases in Canada as well as bases overseas. After the war, when stations were developed or redeveloped, there was always a Roman Catholic chapel and a Protestant chapel. We hadn't reached the point where we could have one church or one chapel serve the two denominations.
Mm-hmm.
There would be chapels on either side of the road facing one another. I think nowadays you could probably have one church serve all denominations.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans got around that rather nicely, and they built a they designed a service with reversible seats, and you could have the setup for the Roman Catholics at one end and for the Anglicans at the other, and all you had to do was reverse the
pew. American ingenuity point.
Out in North Africa, well, now we're not interested in the war period, but I was going to say out in North Africa during the war, I had a wing out there, Canadian wing, and I had an RC chaplain and a Protestant chaplain.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there was always, in a theater, in an operation area like that, there was always a shortage of tentage. You never had of those big marquees. You just had enough to serve your purpose for messes and
hospital
dining room, and the mess was the dining room, really.
Yeah.
For hospitals, for intelligence operations center, and that was it. Beyond that, you had no big tents.
Mm-hmm.
So the question was, where did you hold your
services?
Yeah. Well, it seemed rather obvious that you'd hold your service in the open air. You have nice warm weather, and why not?
Mm-hmm.
But that presented a problem. My RC chaplain found that very difficult to deal with. because he had been brought up, and understandably so, to feel that you had to have a consecrated place to hold service, and that consecrated place had always been a structure or building of some kind. It's easy to consecrate a building in his mind, but it was very difficult to consecrate the open surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a rather inexperienced. He was a fine man, but rather inexperienced. He'd just come out of a small little community in French Canada,
mm-hmm.
and with a great big, always accustomed to a great big church, and here he was expected to function in the open air. I think I was a great pain and trial to him, because I decreed at one point when we were celebrating the anniversary of the Battle of Britain, and this was one of the early celebrations of the Battle of Britain, I was out there in 1943 in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, we will hold the, I called my two chaplains in, I said, we'll hold the memorial service commemorating the Battle of Britain as a body, not as two bodies, as one body. We'll all be together. Go and work out the details. Tell me how you're going to do it. Well, that produced some headaches, I can tell you, but I won't go into that now. I got my way, but I had to deliver the service myself.
So they wouldn't do it?
Oh, yeah, well, they cooperated to a degree, but it was very painful. Yeah.
Well, I guess we should get back to the 30s.
Yeah.
Okay, we've discussed religion and politics.
All right. Let me see. What else would be if...
We talked about your marriage last time and the problems you had with...
Oh, yeah. Well, that's... here are a few customs. Yeah, you remind me. There are a number of customs associated with mass life and married life that we haven't touched on. For example, as a young officer in the service, if you were in a community or a setting where there was more than your own mess, other messes, you always, on arrival at this new location, went and paid your respects to the PMC of the other mess, and left your cards. There was a card rack,
mm-hmm.
On the notice board that was made of crisscross tapes in which you could insert a card, sort of a beige type background. And that would be your calling card when you came to pay your respects to the mess. You left generally a card for yourself and a card for your wife. And
the idea being that they would respond to this
right.
card?
That's right.
And invite you
And if it came time for you to be posted, and when you had notice of your posting and you knew your date of departure, you invariably went to that mess and left your PPC cards.
Mm-hmm.
You know what a PPC card is? You left your calling card, and these were all finely engraved cards in the best tradition. And on the corner of the card, you wrote PPC, and that was, let me see, what did that stand for? Pour Pond Congé, for to take leave. It's your leave-taking card.
Mm-hmm.
It was considered very bad form, very bad taste if you left without leaving those cards, because you might be invited to a party and you're no longer there.
Two empty seats
yeah.
at a table.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that replies, I was referring there to single officers on a base,
mm-hmm.
but the single officers also were required to go not only to call it on neighboring messes, but on the wives of the married officers. For example, at Camp Borden, as a junior officer, I would be required to go and drop a card on the wife of every married officer on the base. They wouldn't always be at home, They generally had their at-home days, and you went and dropped your cards then. But if they weren't home, you just left your card. If you discovered, there were always a few people on the base that you weren't too anxious to call on, because it might be difficult. Maybe they were shy or reticent or overbearing or something like that. Sometimes you were rather happy they weren't home.
Mm-hmm.
And very often, if one junior auction discovered that somebody wasn't at home, he'd circulate that information quickly.
She'd have a pile of cards.
And, of course, putting your PPC card on the mess rack served as information to the other officers that mm-hmm. you were departed, and that you were departing, and that it meant you didn't have to go around and put PPC cards on every one you'd had to call on.
Now, was this rack in the ante room of the mess?
It was in the hallway,
mm-hmm.
adjacent to the ante room, generally. The notice board of the mess,
mm-hmm.
where the DROs are published, and the King's regulations and so on. Now, in a city like Ottawa, or any place where there was a headquarters, see, the Army had headquarters in all the major cities, we didn't have we weren't big enough to have a whole series of headquarters, but we did have headquarters staff in Ottawa. And going there, when I was posted there as a junior officer, I was married in England, you see, when I was on course over there to a Canadian girl who came across from Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
When we got back to Willis, was my second. I had two tours of duty over there as a married officer before the war broke out. When we got back the second time, I was posted to headquarters, so my wife then had to go and call on all the senior officers of the headquarters staff. It would be impossible to call on everybody, I suppose, in headquarters staff. I guess there was everyone above such and such a rank you called on. I can't remember the exact detail on it, but I knew Dawn, and I think she called everyone above the rank of squadron leader and above. And on the wives of the senior officers, at the top level of the other services, too. And also on the ambassador, the High Commissioner from the United Kingdom, the High Commissioner from Australia and New Zealand and South Africa. I don't think it meant Yale and the United States, the ambassador of the United States, and perhaps the ambassador of France, I've forgotten that. But I don't think it went beyond that.
That's
at that stage, that was a lot. Later on, of course, after the war, when we were became part of NATO, then you have, well, okay, I've forgotten. The practice of calling had gone out by then.
Mm-hmm.
There were certain people you called on just in the normal course of events, but you weren't required or compelled to do so. But in those days, these were compulsory things you had to go on.
Sure.
And it was part of the education of the young wife.
I can imagine, yeah.
Some of those old biddies, you know. Some of them were very good. You know, most of them were first class, you know. And they realized that they had a responsibility to help this, integrate this young person into their society, and they did a good job of it. And these teas may have been a bit painful in some respects, but in another case they were often very friendly and very helpful.
Well,
and a bit educational.
Well, put her in touch with people of her own.
That's right.
Background she'd be sure.
Yeah. And if you were liked and respected, both the wife and the husband, it requires some other combination effect here. You would find that you were invited to the dinner party. It may have come about by the fact that somebody was suddenly one of the intended guests wasn't able to come through ill health or posting away or something like that.
But you'd be on the list.
There'd be an invitation sort of out of the blue to go and join a party. But that was all right. That was quite acceptable, and it gave an opportunity to get to know some of the more distinguished members of the community.
Let me ask you another question. How important was a wife for an airman's career? Did you have to choose a wife? That sounds awfully...
Well, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
No, it was... I think it was very important to have the right partner and companion
mm-hmm.
in life. The service didn't rate wives officially, but I'm sure they did unofficially.
Mm-hmm.
If a chap was going to go... if a lad had a really good promise and ability and personality and was likely to go high in the service, he would be held back if he didn't have a proper partner to support him. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
I don't know whether your question was intended to go beyond that or not. Was there any other...
Well, anything you want to add to that,
yeah.
in that same sort of vein, the importance of a wife to a man's career. And
the importance of a wife, furthermore, it was important that the arrangement be a sound one, a marriage which was stormy and on the point of breaking up, or one that would break up. I think certainly at that stage, the stage we're talking about, it was looked askance even for a divorce to take place.
Well, I suppose it was a sign of instability, if nothing
else,
wasn't it?
Yes. And broken marriages were very... rare, extremely rare. I can only remember one
that actually went to divorce and suffering
in that pre-war period, and Bill McBrien, General McBrien's son, was incidentally, he was one of the pupils on that same course of Dave Harding,
mm-hmm.
and he was an extremely good officer, known in the service as Iron Bill. He was a tough disciplinarian. He was the only one I can recall from that era that had a divorce, and his wife was his first wife was very charming, capable person. He didn't divorce her because she wasn't a suitable companion to assist him in his career.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't actually, now you look back on it, quite a number of people in the service took rather dim view of Bill at that time. But in the long run, He married again, and his companion in the second marriage was a happy arrangement, a happy choice. As though he did become an air marshal, so he wasn't held back. He followed me in my position at SHAPE, became deputy commander over there, and they also followed me in my position at NORAD. He didn't follow me as chief of the air staff because there wasn't any longer a position for chief of the air staff. But
any examples you can think of where a bad man?
Let's talk about other aspects of married life. If a wife became alcoholic, of course that would be very detrimental to an officer's career. And that didn't happen very often, fortunately.
Though you would think that she would be open to that, being alone on this base with a few other wives, rather isolated sometimes. But it didn't happen that often.
No, unfortunately it didn't. Let me see what other instances can I think of. What's the situation on that tape? It must be damn nearly out, isn't it?
Oh, we've probably got another 5, 6, 7 minutes.
Oh, I see. Okay. Just cut that thing for a moment.
All right, we'll cut it off now, and we'll...
Yeah, now. Why?